Unreliable power, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. 7 months after Hurricane Maria, Puerto Ricans still can't count on a reliable power supply.
I haven't made any big, like, supermarket purchase since the hurricane because I'm never sure that I'm going to have electricity. I do not rely on it.
Also, Russia's effort to silence a popular messaging app called Telegram falls short.
It's a kind of a game of whack-a-mole because they collectively banned a lot of completely unrelated websites and services. But Telegram is still online.
And can dance parties for the elderly help fight loneliness? Just ask this 93-year-old widow.
This is good thing to make friends, but it's no husband.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. 7 months. That's how long it's been since Hurricane Maria tore through the island of Puerto Rico. It's also how long some residents of the island have been without electricity. And there was another massive power cut on the island this week. An excavator got too close to a high voltage line, tripping an auto safety response. That shut down one power plant, and then others followed. Most of the residents impacted by that accident now have power again. But this is just the latest power-related hiccup on the island since the hurricane. The fact is that tens of thousands of people still don't have full service and aren't expected to get it until mid-May. Admaris Carazo works in marketing and writes a blog called Siempre Jueves about what life has been like for her in the capital, San Juan. Admaris, how did this latest power outage impact you?
Well, we were at least here. I was in my office and everything went out. So now we are all very accustomed to be saving everything because it's usual that the power can get out when you're like in the middle of something important. Then obviously lunchtime was craziness because we have no lights. So the traffic gets amazingly crazy in very little time.
And how long was the power out?
For some people, it was like 8 hours. For some people, it was a whole night. This morning, I had a lot of traffic to come here. So some of the traffic lights are still not working.
Now, in a recent blog post, you talk about getting a tattoo. Can you describe what that tattoo would look like?
Yeah, I was saying I was going to tattoo myself with a hurricane on my left shoulder since we always feel like the hurricane is still like haunting us and we're only 41 days away from the hurricane season again. It's just like a way of trying to, you know, heal the fear that we have, that we continuously have this, you know, post-traumatic stress. Like whenever the generator is going or even when it rains too much, we get really nervous. Like most of us are very scared of starting this hurricane season again.
You know, in your blog, you refer to the beginning of the next hurricane season. You call it the season that can't be named. How are you preparing?
At least at my home, we're already buying a lot of canned food and storing water. My husband thinks I'm being a little bit hysterical about it. But I can see like yesterday when we didn't have power, you already could see the difference on the lines of the gas station. So I think most of us were on the same page. Like it triggers us. So whenever we feel like we're going to be without electricity or without water again, we start like getting all freaked out. It's all the country, like the past, I don't know, 20 years, we were so used of not being hit by hurricanes that we used to be a little bit like precarious, like, no, it's not going to hit us. Like, we're blessed. We're the blessed island. But I think this last year, we had a lesson. So I don't think that's going to happen anymore. I think the supermarkets are going to be cleared out as soon as something appears on the map.
So the hurricane sounds like it's really changed you. In your blog, you describe Hurricane Maria and its impact as a kind of adult slap. What do you mean by that?
I mean, like, I was the kind of person that always had, like, my tank of my car without gas because I can always, you know, just go to the gas station or not having any cash on me, among a lot of other things. Like, I've never realized, like, my parents live more like 25 minutes without traffic from home. But that can become an hour if there are no traffic lights. Like, we don't have a plan of how to get in touch if we don't have telephone lines working or if we don't have electricity or we don't have internet. So those 2 or 3 days, in my case, that I couldn't reach them taught me a lesson. Like, it's not things are not guaranteed.
Do you feel like you're living your life differently? I mean, not just the impact of the hurricane, but how you think about life and what you take for granted?
Definitely. Definitely. I don't think I've ever meditated before about how a warm bath is so important, or being able to refrigerate your food. Like, I haven't made any big, like, supermarket purchase since the hurricane, because I'm never sure that I'm going to have electricity. I do not rely on it the way I used to. So I cook in less portions. I try to buy, I don't know, the proteins or things that need to be refrigerated the same day that I think I'm going to cook them, because you never know. If you don't have electricity, everything is going to be damaged.
I'm curious, were you writing your blog before the hurricane?
Yes, I have that blog like for 7 or 8 years. But in the past years, I've write less and less. Some people say like it's harder to write when you're happier. And everything has been very peaceful and happy before the hurricane. And the hurricane brought a lot of different perspectives and angles of things that I haven't been paying too much attention when everything was working the way it used to.
So, Admarisa, you're going to get that tattoo of a hurricane?
I am really thinking about it. Usually I try to sleep on it 21 days. I've been thinking about it like for 2 weeks now. So probably I will try to do it before the next hurricane comes. Let's hope it doesn't.
Admaris Carazo works in marketing and writes a blog called Siempre Jueves. She's been speaking to us from San Juan. Thanks, Admaris.
Thank you for the time.
Prior to this week's blackout, more than 40,000 Puerto Ricans were still without power. Photojournalist Alex Robluski profiled some of the people who've been living in darkness since Hurricane Maria. You can see his photos over at PRI.org. Remember the caravan of Central American migrants making its way through Mexico? President Donald Trump may have stopped tweeting about it, but it's still on the move. It just looks a bit different now. 50 of the migrants reached the U.S. border this week, and hundreds more are still en route. Leo Olson is with a group called Pueblo Sin Fronteras. He's helping coordinate the caravan. Leo, tell us where you are right now.
Sure. Hi, Carol. We are here in Mazatlan, Sinaloa. We are part of the caravan. We're a smaller group right now. We arrived this morning on buses that were donated from people in Guadalajara, where previously the entire caravan was. The other part of the caravan, mainly men, were mostly women and children here, has continued on the train as we've been traveling mainly since Mexico City.
How many people are with you there?
We're a little under 200, about 170 people right now.
And of course, as you mentioned, the caravan's kind of split off. There's about 50, I understand, have arrived at the U.S. border, but you're part of a different group.
Correct. It's all one caravan. Now, the 50 that arrived at the U.S. border were people who decided to go off and leave the caravan and go ahead to the border. And we, as people who accompany, of course, supported that and support the decision of everyone, wherever they might go. It's just that our group right now is in two smaller factions just due to these buses that were donated, thankfully, to the women and children in Guadalajara. And we gave them the chance to not have to ride on the freight train known as the Beast, where the rest of the group, mostly men, is currently on right now.
So you've got about 170 people there with you in Mazatlan. What's the mood like among them?
The mood is good. We're all feeling well. We traveled by night and arrived here in the early morning, and people continued to rest. Those who were sick have been able to recover. There were some small children who, of course, given the nature of the journey, had taken its toll. So it really was quite a nice and generous thing of the people in Guadalajara to help us with. And it reflects a lot of the unity we've seen here in Mexico, really throughout the entire trip. So the mood is very good. We're resting and we're ready to get back with the group of men and continue our march together.
I know you're sitting with one of the travelers from Central America. Can you introduce us?
Of course, yes. I have Linda here. She's a mother from El Salvador, and I'll be interpreting for her for whatever questions you have. So,
can you ask her what inspired her to join the caravan?
Por el bienestar de mi hijo.
It was for the well-being of my child, because in El Salvador, being a young child is a crime.
And how old is her child, and is her child with her?
Mi hijo menor tiene 15 años. Tengo una de 20.
So my younger child is 15 years old. I also have a child who's 20 who's with me, and the 15-year-old is with here as well, and the 20-year-old is with their baby as well.
What did she mean when she said being a child is a crime in El Salvador?
Eso significa que para nosotras las madres de familia en El Salvador,
it means that for us, the mothers, our kids can't even go to the store, they can't go to study, they can't even go to play ball.
It's that dangerous. It's just too dangerous for them to sort of be kids in El Salvador.
Sí, es demasiado peligroso.
Yes, it's too dangerous. If they stray from their path of where they're going, they'll disappear. They'll get beaten. They'll be taken by the gangs. They'll have to sell drugs, and they'll be forced to go with weapons.
And what's your goal? Where do you hope to end up?
Nosotros vamos con destino para Washington.
Our destination is Washington.
There's a lot of hostile rhetoric coming out of the White House these days. Is Linda worried about reaching the border, and is she confident that she'll get asylum?
Sí, realmente sí. Yo creo que todos los padres estamos preocupados porque...
Yes, I think all of us parents are worried about that. Because when we left, we just can't go back. Now, with my son, we're in a situation where if he didn't join the gangs, they were going to kill all of us. So we just can't return.
What's the next step?
Ahorita nos falta, creo que dos o tres estaciones más.
So right now we have about two or three stops left, and then we're going to have a little preparation before we turn ourselves in. And trusting God, if everything goes well, we'll be able to give our youth the freedom and our sons the freedom to be young, to have a career, and to be well.
So how many more days do you think it's going to take you to get to the border?
It's hard to say, but we are hoping to be at the border, hopefully in Tijuana, by the middle of next week. And we do have some support on the U.S. side, actually quite a lot of support of people who will be coming to support the asylum seekers, the several hundred that they are, in an action of solidarity and unity with their cause and what they've come here for.
And you'll be with them the whole way?
Correct.
Leo Olson is a coordinator with Pueblo Sin Fronteras, which has been organizing the migrant caravan in Mexico. He spoke with us from Mazatlan in Mexico. Thanks so much, Leo.
Thank you so much for the time, guys. We appreciate it.
Here's a hashtag you may have missed on social media this week: Stop the Soot. It's trending in Nigeria. That's because environmental activists held a protest yesterday in the city of Port Harcourt. They say soot, lots of it, has been affecting the health of the city's residents for a couple of years now. Marianne Duke Ocon was at the protest. She says the soot, caused by local industries and the burning of tires, is everywhere.
You wake up in the morning and you can see a dark cloud that is beneath the blue, bright skies, but it covers the blue skies. So it looks like it's about to rain, but it's not going to rain. And as a result of this, your car, you go out in the morning and you just run your finger on your vehicle and you see it's like you have charcoal on your hands. That's how bad it is. You walk around, let's say you're walking from your bedroom to the bathroom, under your feet will be as dark as if you were in a charcoal factory. What we hear, according to the experts, that what we breathe in is a lot more dangerous than what we actually see. For the long term, they're telling us that we might start seeing physical impacts on our health in 5 to 10 years, but mostly it could lead to cancerous diseases. It could lead to upper respiratory diseases, skin diseases, et cetera, et cetera. For me, I was sick for a whole month. I had a cold that was not going anywhere. I was coughing. I wake up in the morning and I can't breathe pretty well because, you know, this is the air that you breathe. So we're already beginning to see the side effects of this thing that is in our air that is called a pollution of sorts. And what we were asking for today when we went out on the streets, we were saying, we do not want excuses. We do not want you to tell us that it's something that has been with us. We want you to do something. Our kids are falling ill every day. We're going in and out of hospitals, and the doctors are telling us that if the source of this soot is not found and clamped down on, then we're going to die. Children are already falling ill without doctors being able to ascertain as to why these children are sick. We have a right to good health, to breathe fresh air. It's our right.
Marianne Duke Ocon speaking to the BBC from the Nigerian city of Port Harcourt. Flying on North Korea's national airline. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a game of whack-a-mole. That's how our next guest describes this week's efforts by the Russian government to shut down the messaging platform Telegram in the country. Russian authorities started implementing the ban earlier this week after the company refused to hand over users' private messaging data to the government, data the Kremlin says it needs for its counterterrorism efforts. 5 days into the ban, Telegram is still operating in Russia, but in their effort to take it down, authorities have caused some collateral damage.
Telegram, immediately after the ban, reverted to cloud backup services, which the Russian authorities also tried to ban, but it's just a complete disaster because they collectively banned a lot of completely unrelated websites and services. So my website went down along with some others.
Alexei Kovalov is a Russian journalist and editor at Coda Story. The nonprofit newsroom's Russian language website is among many sites and services that have been taken offline since the Telegram ban went into effect on Monday.
It looks like if you're riding a bus with a fare dodger, the ticketing inspector, instead of kicking out the fare dodger, just pulls over the entire bus and it's not going anywhere. So that's what happening. That's what happened to my website as well.
So how do you make it available again? What has to happen?
We're just going to have to wait until this government agency unblocks us. But it's taking a while because they're under a lot of stress right now.
Are there workarounds that people can do to get to Kodaroo.com?
Yes, people in Russia can access the website by using certain services like VPNs, virtual private networks, where you essentially, it appears as though you are based somewhere else.
What are the types of services online and offline are being affected as the Russian government moves to block Telegram?
Because Telegram uses the same cloud services on Amazon and Google as many businesses and government agencies even in Russia. What happened is that several banks are malfunctioning, so their ATMs are displaying random jumbles of letters and transactions are not coming through. And there were reports of people being unable to check in on their flights and airports. So, yeah, it's quite a chaotic situation.
So it's affected all sorts of businesses. Some are businesses that the Russian government didn't intend to shut down.
Not at all. So it's very chaotic and it's a huge mess. But Telegram is still online.
Alexei, you mentioned that Telegram has moved part of its infrastructure to the cloud. How do you explain that to someone who doesn't understand it?
Okay, so you have your home address, which is where people know where to find you. But imagine instead of one home address, you now have a million of them. And if the authorities come knocking on your door, they'll have to knock on a million doors instead.
So there's just not one-stop shopping to try to shut down Telegram. It's available on a lot of different addresses.
Yes, that's right.
In the case of your website, Kodaroo, have you reached out to Russian officials to alert them that your site is down? And what have the officials said in response?
Well, nothing. I did file a complaint on these government agencies' website, but so far I've got no response from them.
A lot of observers have noted that in taking this step to ban Telegram, the Russian government is really setting a new precedent for online censorship and heading toward the kind of internet controls that are being used in China. What do you make of that claim?
What this entire situation shows is that Russia is a long way from becoming a second China with some sort of great Russian firewall. Because what this incident shows is that Russia is just too globalized and too dependent on the global services that a lot of businesses, even state corporations in Russia, are using.
Alexei Kovalov is an editor at the nonprofit newsroom Coda Story. Thanks, Alexei.
Thank you.
Air Force Un, that's the nickname some journalists have given to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's official airplane. Clever, huh? Kim's plane is an older Soviet-era model, just like most of the planes flown by Air Koryo, North Korea's national airline. And that's causing some debate over whether Kim's plane can actually make long trips outside the region for diplomatic missions, say for a potential meeting with President Donald Trump next month. Charles Kennedy is a tour leader for Juche Travel Services, which specializes in trips to North Korea. He joins us from London. Charles, you've made 19 trips to North Korea. Tell us a little bit about Air Koryo. What kind of planes does it have, and how many planes are actually operational?
Air Koryo, the national airline of North Korea, their active fleet is 4 aircraft. They've got two Tupolev 204s, which carry about 150 passengers, And they've got two Antonov 148s, which are more of a regional aircraft, carry about 80 passengers. The Tupolev 204s are made in Russia, and the Antonov 148s are made in Ukraine.
And where does Air Koryo fly?
Air Koryo flies to Beijing daily and a couple of days a week to Shenyang, which is also in China, and just across the border to Vladivostok in Russia, and occasionally further afield to Kuala Lumpur, Kuwait, Macau. They'll even pop up in Seoul occasionally.
What kind of people travel on these flights?
The passengers on Air Koryo are a pretty wide mix. Tourists, Chinese businessmen, tourists from China, the occasional diplomat, businessmen from further afield. The flights generally are full.
And what are they like to fly on? You've been on them.
Air Koryo is a pretty normal passenger experience. I think people expect something a little bit more exotic, but the aircraft are actually pretty modern. I think both Tupolevs were built in 2010, and the Antonovs even more recently, I think 2014. An aviation geek would know they're flying on a Russian-built plane, but to a normal airline passenger, it's a normal experience.
What about the food and the in-flight entertainment on Air Koryo?
The service on Air Koryo is actually very good. Cabin crew are really great, very friendly, speak good English. Even though the flight from Beijing is only an hour and a half, they serve snacks and drinks in economy and in first class, a lavish tray of hot food with a tablecloth and china and glass. And the aircraft have flip-down screens which show performances by the famous Moranbong Band, which is a North Korean pop group.
Now, there's all this talk about President Trump and Kim Jong-un possibly meeting at a summit next month, and there's big questions about whether Kim has a plane that could get him very far to a summit. Have you seen Kim Jong-un's plane?
I have, yes. It's often seen parked in Pyongyang. Kim Jong-un is actually quite well known for showing a great deal of interest in aviation. He's a pilot himself. He flies a Cessna recreationally. And the head of state transport for North Korea is an Ilyushin IL-62M, which is a pretty large four-engine jet. The type first flew in 1967, and the actual aircraft that is used by the North Koreans, I think, was built in the early 90s. So it's pretty modern, and it's a long-range aircraft.
So his plane could get him pretty far?
Absolutely. I mean, the published range of the Ilyushin 62 is 6,200 miles, which puts all of Europe and North America within nonstop range. If you were to plan a trip from Pyongyang to New York over the pole, you would probably be looking at refueling, but a big chunk of Russia is on the way, so that would be a very uncontroversial stop. It's not in passenger service anymore anywhere in the world, really, but Sudan and Ukraine still use the Ilyushin 62 for head of state transport. And actually Russia as well. It's a very capable aircraft, and the one that the North Koreans have is in fantastic condition.
Charles Kennedy is a tour leader for a UK-based travel agency that specializes in trips to North Korea. Thanks so much, Charles.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Carol Hills. Poet Kwame Dawes was born in Ghana and raised in Jamaica. Now he's a college professor in Nebraska, and he's been thinking a lot about how to bridge the racial divide in this country.
Somebody says to me, Kwame, I can't imagine what you go through as a black person, and I'll say, try.
Creating empathy in America. That's ahead, here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It sounds like something out of Harry Potter, but this is not fiction. Back in January, British Prime Minister Theresa May named a Minister for Loneliness.
In a country of more than 60 million people, and in an age where we can instantly connect with friends, relatives, and even strangers around the world, it may seem counterintuitive that any of us could find ourselves feeling lonely. Yet more than 9 million of us say that we always or often feel lonely.
The UK may be right to take this seriously. A growing body of research suggests loneliness can affect your health. More on that in a bit. But now we're going to spend some time looking at ways people around the world are dealing with loneliness. We'll start in the Netherlands. Amsterdam has brought dozens of groups together to look at the best ways to ease isolation. Venetia Rainey dropped in on a couple of those projects.
In a small room on a quiet street in the north of Amsterdam, a handful of women are dancing to a few well-chosen classics. This is the Music Salon, a music and dance club for the elderly established last year by a group called the Dance Palace. They also organised bigger events, but realised they weren't frequent enough to make a real difference in people's lives. What's your name?
My name is Rie van der Muren.
And how old are you?
93.
And do you live alone?
Yes. My husband died 13 years ago.
Rie says she often feels lonely these days, especially now that so many of her friends have died too. To fight it, she joins card games, goes on walks, and takes the bus places. This is her first time at the music salon, but she says she finds it a bit small. She explains that she used to do professional ballroom dancing with her husband, so she's accustomed to something a bit grander.
We always danced cha-cha-cha and quick step. And English waltz. Oh, it is nice. It's nice to do. I can't sit always one place. I want to go here and there and there. This is good to make friends. Yes. But it's no husband.
Still, the music salon has received a lot of positive reviews from participants. Enough for the organisers to expand it to 3 other neighbourhoods in Amsterdam and a 4th in Rotterdam. They've also set up another programme that sends volunteers into people's homes to play records and chat one-on-one. They came up with this because they know that some people just don't have the confidence or even the physical ability to leave the house and seek company. And that's where projects like Radio Steunkous come in.
Heel hartelijk welkom bij Radio Steunkous.
Ellie Lakeveld works for Broedzorg, a community nursing agency here in the Netherlands. Many of their clients are homebound, so the issue of loneliness comes up a lot.
So one of our colleagues, Marjolein, had the idea, why don't we make our own radio program? It's an opportunity for people who are more or less housebound to have a connection with the world outside.
When I meet the team, they're busy setting up for a special show being recorded in a large clinic in East Amsterdam. Marjolein Envlet is the producer. She calls herself an audio nurse. She's busy running around, making sure everything is ready to go live at 2 p.m. as usual.
Goedemiddag luisteraars, hartelijk welkom bij Radio Steunkous.
After it's over, she tells me that when the municipality launched their anti-loneliness initiative last year, she knew instantly that the show's team should be part of it.
We found lonely people who want to become a reporter in our format. So they go out and talk to other people who are lonely, or they tell how they experience their day and how it is to be lonely and what they self think can help to change their situation.
The segment they added is called Not Alone with a Microphone. Marjolein tells me about one elderly woman who wanted to highlight that it's not just old people who get lonely. Radio Steunkous helped to interview students at a local school about feeling alone.
And it was such a wonderful talk, and she could listen so well. And the youth also said, well, we never talked in this way about loneliness before, and it's so nice to talk to somebody who's older and has these other experiences.
Radio Steunkous and the Music Salon are both small initiatives with a limited reach, but at least anecdotally, they're having some results. And for now, this highly localised approach is the closest Amsterdam has to an answer to loneliness. It's a work in progress that city officials hope will continue and maybe even inspire other cities to follow their lead. For The World, Venetia Rainey, Amsterdam, the Netherlands.
Japan has been wrestling with a loneliness problem too. How to help the hundreds of thousands of people who have dropped out of society and shut themselves in their homes. Now, a former shut-in thinks he's found a way to give them a voice and bring them back. From Tokyo, Abigail Leonard has our story.
Up a narrow flight of stairs is a cafe where 10 people sit around a table. For some of them, it's the first time they've been out in weeks. They're here for an editorial meeting of the Hikikimori newspaper. It's written by shut-ins about their experience. The first order of business is to talk about their own daily struggles, just to get out the door. One man says he's tired all the time and doesn't want to socialize, but is pushing himself to do it. Hikikomori are defined as people who haven't left their homes or interacted with anyone for 6 months. The editor of the paper is Naohira Kimura. He's 33, tall, and soft-spoken. And he says he hardly left his house for 10 years.
It was a very painful period. It wasn't just that I was sad. There was this deep loneliness that made me feel like I was getting sicker and sicker.
It began as he was preparing to take the law school entrance exam. Months and then years went by, as his peers got jobs and moved on. But he couldn't bring himself to take the test. Ashamed, he stayed inside, leaving only to buy food.
I felt like I was being left behind, left out of society. And physically, I kept getting worse. So I started buying psychology books and exercising, running, doing bench presses.
During that 10 years, did you ever seek professional help? Or were you really just working on it on your own?
No, I was too ashamed to share my feelings with the doctor. Plus, I really didn't consider myself a shut-in. I just couldn't see what was happening.
He only began to understand when his mother sought psychiatric help for her own stress over his condition. She brought him to see Tamaki Sato, a psychologist who coined the term hikikomori in the 80s. Was that a surprise to you when you heard them give you that label?
I was upset and angry. I thought he was making a fool of me.
It's not surprising. Hikikomori carries a stigma here, even though it's so widespread that the Crown Princess of Japan was considered a shut-in for a time. But Kimura eventually accepted his diagnosis, and counseling helped mend his relationship with his mother.
So there are obviously lonely people everywhere, but how do you explain why there are so many shut-ins in Japan?
It's a society that's not very accepting of mistakes. And so if people make a mistake, they become ashamed and basically retreat to their home.
It is not a sickness, it is not an illness either.
Kikuyo Aoki runs a clinic funded by the Tokyo government that provides counseling and job placement for hikikomori.
This has more become really a social condition.
Sometimes families of hikikomori get so desperate they call in high-priced so-called support organizations to physically force people out of the house. Scenes from these violent interventions have even broadcast on national television, like this one, showing men pounding on a hikikomori's door. Kimura says seeing one of these shows inspired him to start the newspaper. He wanted to give shut-ins a way to explain themselves, especially to their parents.
I want people to understand that shut-ins aren't lazy. They want to have human relationships, so we shouldn't attack them. We should approach them with warmth.
They're not a small group either, 500,000 according to government estimates. And that doesn't include people over 40. Kimura thinks the real number is closer to 1 million. And in the newspaper's inaugural issue, his team accused the government of understating the problem. At the editorial meeting over glasses of spicy plum tea, the writers consider the theme for the next issue. Kimura suggests they look at the parents' experience.
The families have been extremely happy because before this, they couldn't understand their children's experience.
But there is one issue.
Many of the writers got used to working and more are going back to work, so that's good. But now I have fewer people to do the paper.
That's great, though. Congratulations. For you personally, is it sort of therapeutic to come together with like-minded people and talk these things over?
For me, the paper developed my interpersonal communication, and that helped me overcome my depression. You know, hikikomori are not unique to Japan. There are people all over the world who feel this kind of pain. If people are lonely, if they're suffering, it's really important to reach out and communicate with other people. That's how you start to heal.
For the World, Abigail Leonard, Tokyo.
I have Julianne Holt Lundstad on the line. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University, and she studies the health impact of loneliness. Julianne, how do you define loneliness for the purpose of a health study? Because it seems kind of subjective.
Yeah, in fact, it by definition is subjective, because loneliness is the subjective feeling of isolation, and it's often defined as the discrepancy between one's desired level of social connection and one's actual level. And so, as you can imagine, this may vary from person to person. My desired level of social connection might differ from your desired level of social connection.
So someone may be alone a lot, but they may not desire much social connection, so they're not classified as lonely.
Correct. But yet, even being objectively isolated is also associated with risk.
I've seen loneliness compared to obesity and smoking as a risk factor. Is that right?
Well, where this comes from is a meta-analysis that I conducted, which in essence combined all of the available evidence worldwide and its effect on risk for premature mortality. And we compared it to known effects of things such as smoking, obesity, physical inactivity, alcohol consumption, air pollution. And when we averaged across indicators of social disconnection, which would include both the objective and subjective, this was associated with a risk comparable to smoking up to 15 cigarettes per day and exceeded some of these others.
I wonder if your interest is in having doctors now include questions about loneliness in their kind of regular checkup. You know, they'll ask you if you're safe at home and that kind of thing. Are you trying to get loneliness as a issue that should be addressed as a public health problem?
Absolutely. We now have hundreds of studies with millions of participants that document this effect. And what this data shows is that this is not only comparable, but exceeds these other risk factors that we take very seriously in public health. And so when physicians talk to their patients and they talk to them about their lifestyle, this should be part of that.
You know, in talking to you about this, it's hard not to raise the issue of social media, which is seen both as a way of connecting people and as a way of keeping people very isolated. Do you see social media as playing any role in either the increase or decrease of loneliness?
You know, that's a great question. And I think this is one of the biggest questions that not only the public has, but also researchers have. So one thing to keep in mind is that it is relatively recent in the sense that by some estimates, it was only 2012 that more than half the population had smartphones. And so if we use that marker as a point in time when the majority of people are using social media, that's really only been in the last 6 years. And if you think about the evidence that established the risk, this followed people over often decades to see if the level of social connection or lack of social connection predicted risk for mortality or premature mortality. And so we really don't have a good sense of the long-term effects of this. And yet we do know that this is now the primary means of social communication. And so it's a very important question.
Julianne Holt-Lundstad is professor of psychology and neuroscience at Brigham Young University. Thanks, Julianne.
Thank you.
Poet Kwame Dawes was born in Ghana, but spent most of his childhood in Jamaica. These days, he's teaching at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He recently sent out a tweet that caught our eye. Dawes posted it after the incident at a Philadelphia Starbucks earlier this month. Two black men were arrested on suspicion of trespassing after a white employee called the police. The two were simply waiting for a business associate to show up. Dawes says the episode reminded him of a time when something similar happened to him in Nebraska. And it got him thinking about what happens before police are called to that sort of scene.
The threat of some kind of confrontation represents almost a weapon to somebody who may be upset with you who is white and you're black. And in a sense, the people who we don't persecute much or sort of pay enough attention to prosecute much, when we don't pay enough attention to, are the people who make that call. And very often they make that call just out of petty annoyance or, you know, just, okay, I'm going to show you. But they know full well the implications of a police coming into a situation that is so racially charged, and the black person rarely gets the better deal in that situation. And so it struck me that there's another narrative there that is actually more daily. And of course, my tweet began to, you know, sort of unearth all kinds of people saying, you know, this happens to me all the time. And it's a striking thing because I think it's an everyday thing. And it's masked by the fundamental sense that the person who makes the call is just being a good citizen. And that's horrendously scary.
What happened to you in a Starbucks in Lincoln?
It wasn't a Starbucks. It was actually a Ross's supermarket. And I went in there to buy some groceries. I'd spent over $100 on groceries. And I was trying to get them to use my, I guess they have these cards that you can get a discount for, you know, when you shop there. And I forgot to give the card to the cashier before he checked everything in. And then so I said, can you put it in? And he says, no, he can't. And so that became a whole discussion. And I said, well, I think you can because you've done this before. Or, you know, I've done this before. Finally, a manager comes and says, you need to leave because this is not happening. We're not doing it. And I was saying, look, this is my right and this is not the way to go. Eventually, the conversation led to him saying, I'm going to call the police right now because you need to leave. Which is a fascinating moment. Of course, my reaction was, please do. I mean, I think we need some intervention here. But as I left, I just started to get nervous because I realized that that would not necessarily work out usefully. But he was angry with me, and his threat was not just a threat for creating order. His threat was to say, I have the police on my side. That's my weapon to you. That is the thing that scares a black man. And I'm afraid he's kind of right.
Did the police come?
No, they didn't come because I left.
Now, you're in the prairie land of Nebraska. You're in Lincoln. It's a college town. But it's a long way from Jamaica or Ghana or Nigeria or anywhere else. Do you feel at home there?
That's a tough question. But I would say that there's a way in which one finds a settling in places. I've been there since 2011. And so there's a comfort being in Nebraska. Nebraska is a comfortable place in many ways. Things work. Everything in Lincoln is 20 minutes away. The weather is not something that bothers me. I enjoy the weather and so on. They have great cycled tracks, you know, cycled paths and so on. So there's that comfort, but there's also a sense that I'm an alien in that space. I'm acutely aware of my alienation in that space, and that what we are enacting and what we are practicing is a way of coexisting and living. I think the quest for home is more complicated for me in Nebraska than it was for me when I was living in South Carolina for about 19 years, where I still regard South Carolina as comfortably home.
What was the difference?
Well, there's one fundamental difference is the narrative of history. You know, if you've come from a post-colonial space, a space that was once colonized by imperial forces, you understand the psyche of having been dominated and therefore the process of trying to find your own dignity and identity out of it. In many ways, South Carolina represents that both for the African-American people, but even for white South Carolinians, because, of course, South Carolina was part of the rebellion, the Confederacy, and lost. So the idea of what loss means changes attitudes of people, that the capacity to understand being the underdog is there. Now, there can be a pernicious side to that, but I think that connection was important. And, of course, the more obvious fact was South Carolina is something like 30% or 35% African-American. And it certainly became a place, a kind of cocoon, a kind of protective place to be a part of that community and to be welcomed by that community, which has always remained one of the great gifts that I've had coming to America.
I heard you say once that all acts of hatred or racism or bigotry are predicated on a lack of imagination. What do you mean?
It seems to me that if we think of the idea of empathy, because I think fundamentally empathy represents the idea that I can imagine what somebody else is going through. And in my humanity, if I can imagine that, then I can understand that pain. And if I'm not a sociopath, then I would care not to hurt that person because I wouldn't want to be hurt myself. So on that fundamental basis, but the act of empathy is fundamentally an act of imagination. It's an act that says, somebody says to me, Kwame, I can't imagine what you go through as a black person. And I'll say, try. Because the act of trying is to say, you're going to imagine. And if you don't practice imagining, then you don't practice empathy. And if you don't practice empathy, then fundamentally you're building a circumstance in our world where that lack of empathy creates wars, creates violence, creates racism. So I do believe that very often those pernicious things, racism and so on, are a failure of the imagination, a failure of not being able to enter into somebody else's experience and therefore act in love and act in compassion and so on. So, yeah, I really believe that, which is why I believe in writing. I believe in reading. I believe in literature. I believe in poetry, because I think poetry is one of those tools that helps you strengthen the muscle of empathy. And the muscle of empathy is held together by the imagination.
Poet Kwame Dawes teaches at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. This weekend, he's reading at the Split This Rock Poetry Festival in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much, Kwame.
Thank you.
Here's a nice way to head into the weekend. Recently, we asked you to send in stories of times when you either gave or received a random act of kindness. Here's one that was sent in. Listener Barbara Wells Alexander met a veteran in a coffee shop. I kept thinking about getting him a gift certificate and finally found the courage to do it, Barbara writes. He told me that he served 20 years in the military, including 2 tours in Vietnam. Barbara told the man, "Well, I'm very glad you're here." And he just started to cry and said, "Me too." "Best $20 I ever spent in my life," Barbara writes. "My best cry, too." Barbara shared her experience because of Bren Bataclan, a Filipino-American artist we featured on Monday's show. Bataclan's act of kindness is to give away his paintings to strangers. Now he wants to give one to you. Just go to the World's Facebook page and share your random act of kindness. Bataclan will be back on the show soon to pick his 2 favorites. The prize is a Bren Bataclan painting. And that's all from us today. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
PRI, Public Radio International.